Hachette Audio presents The Identicals, written by Ellen Hildebrand, read by Aaron Bennett. Dedication for Eric, Randy, Heather, and Doug. Together we stand. Nantucket. Like thousands of other erudite, discerning people, you've decided to spend your summer vacation on an island off the coast of Massachusetts. You want postcard beaches. You want to swim, sail, and surf in Yankee blue waters. You want to eat clam chowder and lobster rolls, and you want those dishes served to you by someone who calls them chowder and lobster. You want to ride in a Jeep with the top down, your golden retriever, named Charles Emerson Winchester III, riding shotgun. You want to live the dream. You want an American summer. But wait, you're torn. Should you choose Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard? And does it really matter? Aren't the islands pretty much the same? We chuckle and smirk at the assumption shared by so many. Possibly you're not familiar with a bumper sticker, a bestseller at the hub on Main Street, and proudly displayed on the vehicles of nearly every islander of distinction, including the director of the Nantucket Island Chamber of Commerce, that reads, "God made the vineyard, but he lives on Nantucket." If you're not swayed by that kind of shameless propaganda, then consider the vital statistics. Nantucket Island. Settled, 1659. Original inhabitants, Wampanoag Indians. Distance from Hyannis, 30 miles. Area, 45 square miles. Population, 11,000 year-round, 50,000 summer. Number of towns, 1. Famous residents, prefer not to be named. Martha's Vineyard. Settled, 1642. We say age before beauty. Original inhabitants, Wampanoag Indians. Distance from Woods Hole, 11 miles. We say, it's practically the mainland. Area, 100 square miles. We say, twice as big. Population, 16,535 year-round, 100,000 summer. We say, twice as many. Number of towns, 6. We are speechless. And can someone please tell us what is up with Chappaquiddick? Famous residents, Meg Ryan, Lady Gaga, Skip Gates, Vernon Jordan, Carly Simon, James Taylor, and John Belushi, deceased and buried off South Road. They have Bluto. We say, so what? Is there any part of Martha's Vineyard that can compete with our cobblestone streets or the stately perfection of the Three Bricks, the homes that whale oil merchant Joseph Starbuck built for his three sons between 1837 and 1840? Does the vineyard have an enclave of tiny rose-covered cottages, as whimsical as dollhouses, as we do in the picturesque village of Sconset? Does MYV have a protected arm of Golden Sand Beach, home to piping plovers and a colony of seals, as our northernmost tip, Great Point, does? Does it have a sweeping vista like the one offered across Sackage Pond toward the peppermint stick of Sankaty Head Lighthouse? Does it have a dive bar as glamorously gritty as the Chicken Box, where one can hear Grace Potter one week and Trombone Shorty the next? You might not want to get us started on the superiority of our restaurants. If it were our last night on Earth, who among us could choose between the cheeseburger with garlic fries from the Languedoc Bistro and the seared scallop taco with red cabbage slaw from Millie's? We understand how you might confuse those of us here with our compatriots there. After all, our region is lumped together as the Cape and the Islands, but we are two distinct nations, each with its own ways, its own means, its own traditions, histories, and secrets, and its own web of gossip and scandal. Think of the two islands as you would a set of twins. Outwardly, we look alike, but beneath the surface, We are individuals. Martha's Vineyard. There is a bumper sticker, a bestseller according to the owner of Allie's General Store, that reads, God made Nantucket, but he lives on the vineyard. Some of us would have edited that bumper sticker to say, but he lives in Chilmark, because who wants to be lumped in with the honky-tonk shenanigans happening down island? However, in the interest of keeping this a foreign war and not a civil one, let's celebrate the reasons we're superior to Nantucket. The vineyard has diversity of races, of opinions, of terrain. We have the Methodist campground with its colorful gingerbread houses, the Tabernacle, Ocean Park, Inkwell Beach, Donovan's Reef, home of the Dirty Banana, and that's only in Oak Bluffs. We have dozens of family farms that harvest an abundance of organic produce. We have the Jaws Bridge and the Cliffs of Aquinnah. We have East Chop, West Chop, the Katama Airstrip, and a neighbor in Edgartown who keeps llamas on his front lawn. We have Chappaquiddick, which is a lot more than just the place where Teddy Kennedy may or may not have driven Mary Jo Kopechne to her death off the Dyke Bridge. After all, there is a Japanese garden on Chappie. And if we let the air in our Jeep tires down to 11 pounds and pay $200 for a sticker, we can enjoy the wild, windswept beauty of Cape Pogue. We have rolling hills, deciduous trees, and low stone walls. We have Menemsha, the best fishing village in the civilized world, where one can get the freshest seafood, the creamiest chowder, and the crispiest, most succulent fried whole-belly clams. Have you never heard of the Bight? Larson's? The Home Port? These are iconic spots. These are legends. We have the best celebrations. Illumination Night, the Ag Fair, the August Fireworks. We aren't sure what anyone celebrates on Nantucket other than being able to land a plane successfully at the airport despite the pea soup fog, or finally being able to find the correct shade of dusty pink on a pair of dress pants. But what really makes the vineyard special is the people. The vineyard boasts a large and active population of middle and upper-class African Americans. We have a Brazilian church. We also have celebrities, but you would never recognize half of them because they have to wait in line at Backdoor Donuts and sit in traffic at Five Corners in Vineyard Haven, just like everyone else. Most of us have only been to Nantucket for one reason, the Island Cup. We won't say anything about the football game itself because no one likes a braggart. But every time we visit to cheer on our high school players, we can't help wondering how our fellow islanders can bear to live on such a flat, barren, and foggy rock so far out to sea. Still, there is a connection between us that's hard to refute. Geologists suspect that as recently as 23,000 years ago, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, and Cape Cod were all part of one landmass. It might be easier to think of us as sisters, twins even, birthed by the same mother. We like to think of Martha's Vineyard as the favorite. But then, of course, Nantucket likes to think of herself as the favorite. Martha's Vineyard, Harper. Reed Zimmer isn't on call at 7 o'clock p.m. on Friday, June 16, when Harper Frost's father, Billy, draws his final breath. Dr. Zimmer is at a picnic at Lambert's Cove with his wife's family. Apparently, they hold the same party every year at the start of summer. Bonfire, potato salad, chicken blackening on the portable Weber grill. Sadie Zimmer's brother, Franklin Phelps, is one of the vineyard's favorite guitar players. Harper always goes to hear him when he's playing at the Ritz, and Harper imagines Dr. Zimmer, his feet buried in the cold sand, singing along with Franklin to Wagon Wheel. Harper is still at her father's bedside when she sends Dr. Zimmer a text. It says, Billy is gone. She imagines his shock followed by his guilt. He promised Harper it wouldn't happen tonight. He told her that Billy still had time. Check in on him as usual, Dr. Zimmer had said that afternoon when he rose from Harper's bed, the white sheets tangled from their lovemaking. But feel free to enjoy your weekend. He had looked out her window at the lilac bush, which, overnight it seemed, had exploded into a show-offy bloom. "I can't believe it's all starting again. Another summer." "Feel free to enjoy your weekend?" Harper had thought. She hated when Reed talked to her as though she were merely his patient's daughter, a virtual stranger. But isn't she a stranger to him, in a way? Reed only sees Harper when she's sitting by her father's hospital bed, or when they're making love in her duplex. They don't go on dates. They have never bumped into each other at Kronig's. Reed claims he has never noticed her driving the Rooster delivery truck, even when she waves at him like a woman drowning. Harper and Reed have been sleeping together only since October, and so she isn't sure what another summer means to him. Today offered the first clue. His wife's parents, the elder Phelpses, are now in residence at their house in Katama, recently arrived back from Vero Beach. There will be family obligations, such as this picnic, when it will seem as though Reed is living on another planet. Harper waits a few moments before texting anyone else. Her father is right here, but he's gone. His face is slack. It looks vacated, like a house where there's no one home. Billy died while Harper was talking to him about Dustin Pedroia of the Red Sox. He took one great, shuddering breath, then another. Then he looked right into Harper's eyes, into her heart, into her soul, and said, "I'm sorry, kiddo." And that was it. Harper put her ear to his chest. The machine issued its sustained beep, calling the game. Over. Reed doesn't text back. Harper tries to remember if there is cell reception at Lambert's Cove. She is always making excuses for him. Because of the three men now remaining in her life, he's the one she's in love with. She sends the same text. "Billy is gone." To Sergeant Drew Truman of the Edgartown Police Department. Harper and Drew have been dating for 3 weeks. He asked her out while they were both on the Chappie Ferry, and Harper thought, why not? Drew Truman belongs to one of the most prominent African-American families in Oak Bluffs. His mother, Yvonne Truman, served as a selectman for more than 10 years. She is one of the 5 Snyder sisters, all of whom own brightly colored, impeccably maintained gingerbread cottages facing Ocean Park. Harper remembered Drew back when he was a high school athlete featured every week in the Vineyard Gazette sports pages. He then went to college in the police academy before coming home to Dukes County to serve and protect. Harper had thought that dating someone new might ameliorate the agony of seeing a married man. She and Drew have gone out 6 times. They've eaten Mexican food at Sharky's 4 times. It's Drew's favorite, for reasons Harper can't quite comprehend. They had lunch once at the Katama Airstrip Diner, and their most recent date was a fancy night out at the seafood shanty. Surf and turf, water views, singing waiters. Harper knows that Drew expected sex at the end of the night, but Harper has been able to hold him off thus far, citing her dying father as the reason she can't be intimate. Drew is keen to introduce Harper to his mother, his brother, his brother's wife, his nieces and nephews, his aunties, his cousin's children, the whole extended Snyder-Truman family. But this, too, is a step Harper isn't ready to take. Part of her does yearn to be taken in, fussed and clucked over, cooked for, admired and petted, even argued with and looked askance at because her skin is white. In short, there is appeal in being official with Drew. But the harsh reality remains. Harper loves Reed, and only Reed. Harper sighs. Drew is working the beat tonight. He makes double time on weekends. But with all the bozos out drinking too much and enjoying the first days of the summer season, is it worth it? He'll go on 30 calls, she bets, and 27 of them will be drunken disorderlies, and 3 will be accidents involving taxi drivers who haven't learned their way around yet. The 3rd man remaining in Harper's life is her precious, damaged friend Brendan Donegal, who is exiled over on Chappie. Harper wants to let Brendan know that Billy has died, but Brendan can't manage texting anymore. Like 26 killer wasps, the alphabet swarms him. He uses his phone only to tell the time. Nothing from Dr. Zimmer. Will Harper be forced to call? She calls Dr. Zimmer all the time because she has had many legitimate questions about her father's condition. Liver failure, kidney failure, congestive heart failure. Billy Frost's end has been a series of failures. Surely no one will fault Harper for calling Reed now, after her father has died. But she has an uncomfortable premonition. She waits. Billy Frost is dead at the age of 73. Harper takes a stab at writing his obituary in her mind as the nurses come in to clean him up and prepare him for the fun-filled ride to the morgue. William O'Shaughnessy Frost, master electrician and avid Red Sox fan, died last night at Martha's Vineyard Hospital in Oak Bluffs. He is survived by his daughter, Harper Frost, and his daughter, Tabitha Frost, and his granddaughter, Ainsley Cruz, and his ex-wife, Eleanor Roxy Frost, all of Nantucket, Massachusetts. What will surprise people the most? Harper wonders. That Billy has a daughter identical to but completely different from the cute screw-up who delivers packages for Rooster Express? Or that Billy used to be married to the famous Boston fashion designer Eleanor Roxy Frost, more commonly known as ERF? Or will the shocker be that the other half of Billy's family lives on the rival island, that fancy upscale haven for billionaires? Harper's twin sister, Tabitha, hasn't set foot on Martha's Vineyard in 14 years, and Harper's mother, Eleanor, hasn't been here since her honeymoon in 1968. Harper's niece, Ainsley, has never been here. Billy had been sad about that. When he wanted to see Ainsley, he had to go to Nantucket, which he did religiously every August. "You sure you don't want to come with me?" he used to ask Harper. "I'm sure," Harper would say. "Tabitha doesn't want me there." "When will you girls learn?" Billy would reply, and Harper would mouth along with him. "Family is family." Family is family, Harper thinks. That's the problem. Nothing back from Reed. Harper imagines him eating pie. Reed's wife, Sadie, is famous for her pies. Her mother used to have a stand along the side of the road, and Sadie has capitalized on that artisanal pie-making endeavor and turned it into a gold mine. She rents a small commercial kitchen and storefront in Vineyard Haven. It's a scant mile from Harper's duplex and cranks out the pies: strawberry rhubarb, blueberry peach, lobster pot. A lobster pot pie costs $42. Harper knows this because, near the end of his life, Billy Frost became a fan. One of his female admirers, and there were many, dropped off a lobster pot pie all warm and fragrant and filled with claw and knuckle meat in a thick sherry cream sauce under golden pastry, and Billy declared that he had died and, against all expectations, gone to heaven. When Billy got really bad but could still eat, Harper had felt it her duty to buy him a lobster pot pie. She had entered the shop, the upper crust, with trepidation, knowing she was most likely going to come face to face with her lover's wife for the first time. Harper was forearmed, but seeing Sadie had come as a shock. She was far shorter than Harper had expected. Her head barely cleared the top of the pie case. Her hair was cut short like a boy's, and her eyes bulged, giving her the expression of a cartoon character perpetually caught by surprise. Sadie didn't seem to have any idea who Harper was. She displayed no wariness, just a pleasant smile that revealed a gap between her two front teeth. Harper knew that some men found a gap like that sexy, although Harper never understood the attraction. If her own teeth had looked like that, she would have beat it straight to the orthodontist. "Can I help you?" Sadie had asked. "My father is dying," Harper blurted out. Sadie's eyes popped a little more. "He wants a lobster pot pie," Harper said. "It's the one thing he's been asking for. Mrs. Tobias dropped one off last week for him, and he can't stop talking about it. Mrs. Tobias is an excellent customer, Sadie said. She tilted her head. Is your father Billy Frost, by any chance?
Yes, Harper said. She felt like she was on a roller coaster, cresting, cresting.
Mrs. Tobias told me he was sick. You know, he installed some light fixtures for me when I first opened this shop. He was the only electrician who was willing to do it. Everyone else said I had to call the contractor who had wired it back when it was a scented candle place, but that guy had long ago gone to jail.
Buttons, Harper said, almost involuntarily. Billy had absorbed much of Buttons Jones's business when Buttons was indicted for tax evasion. Sadie retrieved a lobster pot pie hot from the oven. For a second, Harper thought the pie would be free of charge, a gift for a man who had long ago done Sadie Zimmer a solid.
That'll be $42, Sadie said.
Harper has a hard time imagining Reed and Sadie together at home. She knows which house is theirs. It's in West Tisbury, near the Field Gallery, but she's never been inside. She can more easily imagine the Zimmers sitting side by side in the sand in front of the fire at Lambert's Cove. Maybe Sadie has a beautiful singing voice, whereas Harper, although she loves to sing at the top of her lungs in the Rooster Express delivery truck, can't carry a tune. It isn't a competition, Harper knows, not in a column of pros and cons way. Love is a mystery. One of Billy's nurses, Dee, pokes her head into the room.
How you holding up?
Harper tries to nod. Okay. But all she can do is stare. I can't reach Dr. Zimmer, she says. Then she worries that she has just given it all away.
I mean, I know he's not on call, but I thought I should tell him. Billy was his favorite patient.
Dee gives Harper an indulgent smile, and Harper nearly expects her to say that all Dr. Zimmer's patients are his favorites. That is the wonder of Dr. Zimmer. Then Harper worries that Dee is waiting for her to vacate the room. After all, she is no longer a paying customer. But instead, Dee says,
You were good to him, Harper. In some ways, you'll probably find this is a blessing.
A blessing? Harper thinks angrily. She wants to tell Dee to go eat some more cake, but then she wonders if maybe Dee is right. For the past 10 months, Harper's entire existence has consisted of worrying that Billy was going to die. Now that he's gone, she is, in a way, free. There is nothing else to worry about. But she is left with a heavy mantle of grief, sadness so intense and piercing it should have another name. Since her parents' divorce, when she was 17, Billy has been her parent. He was her friend, her hero, her unfailing ally, her everyday companion. She could not have dreamed up a better father. And now he's gone. Gone. Harper wipes away her tears, sucks in a sustaining breath, and says, like the brave soldier Billy believed her to be, Onward.
Atta girl, Dee says. I'll go fetch Billy's things.
Onward. As per Billy's wishes, his body will be cremated, and his memorial reception will be held at the Farm Neck Golf Club. Once Harper sells Billy's house, she will be able to quit her job at Rooster Express, a desperation job she got 3 years ago when Jude fired her from Garden Goddesses following the Joey Bowen catastrophe. And then what will Harper do? She could, in theory, start her own landscaping company. She's sure the clients still ask for her, and not just because she used to mow their lawns in a bikini top. She is a nice person and a good person, despite circumstantial evidence to the contrary. Dee reappears with paperwork for Harper to sign and a large Ziploc bag containing Billy's clothes and belongings, including the gold 1954 Omega watch he inherited from his own father, which was the possession he had treasured the most. Billy Frost had come to Martha's Vineyard in 1995, left flat broke by his divorce from Eleanor, and he had floundered, Harper knew, just as she had that same year as a freshman at Tulane. Billy had scavenged work as an electrical contractor, picking up scraps and leftovers from people like Buttons Jones. He had befriended the guys who cut down trees and moved houses and insulated crawl spaces. He befriended the fishermen and first mates, the transients and junkies who hung out at the wharf pub and who, when they were flush, bothered Carmen, the bartender at Coupe de Ville. But Billy always wore his watch, the Gold Omega, and this had set him apart. What will Harper do with the watch? She has no one to pass it on to. Tabitha has Ainsley, but what does a 16-year-old girl want with a gold 1954 Omega? Harper thinks of Ainsley's father, Wyatt. Billy had been fond of Wyatt, but can Harper ever suggest that Wyatt take the watch? No. Tabitha is a toothache that can't be ignored for another second. 6 weeks earlier, when Billy got really bad, Harper copied Tabitha's cell number out of Billy's contacts and, with the help of half a dozen Amity Island ales and 3 shots of Jägermeister, left Tabitha a voicemail informing her that if she wanted to see Billy one last time before he died, she had better do it soon. Tabitha had never responded. No surprise there. Harper wishes she had called Tabitha while sober, because she fears she slurred her words in the message, making it that much easier to disregard and delete. Billy's death warrants another phone call, but Harper is too angry to conduct one civilly. Did Tabitha deign to listen to the message? Did she come visit? Has she set foot on the vineyard even once since the death of her son Julian 14 years ago? She has not. Nantucket is 11.2 miles away, so it certainly hasn't been an issue of proximity. Harper sends Tabitha the same text. Billy is gone. And then, once safely inside her Bronco, Harper breaks down and calls Dr. Zimmer. The phone rings 6 times, then he answers, voice hushed. Harper imagines he has stepped away from the bonfire and is standing in the shadows. He says, "I'm sorry, Harper. I thought there was more time. Weeks." What kind of doctor is he? She wants to believe him incompetent or hate him, but she can't. Reed gives everything he has to his patients. He stays late to do rounds. He never rushes. He is thoughtful, consistent, kind, clear. Not once in 10 months did Harper ever feel like he wanted or needed to be someplace else. Billy might have been his only patient. Dr. Zimmer would, on occasion, show up with a surprise or treat for Billy. The Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, an arrowhead he'd discovered on a hike, a box of stoner food from Enchanted Chocolates, which he knew Billy loved and technically wasn't allowed to have. Reed Zimmer was like a doctor from TV, but better because he was real. He was both handsome and human. Sometimes he had bags under his eyes from staying up all night. Sometimes he had scruff on his face or mussed hair. Sometimes he showed up wearing jeans and a gray t-shirt under his white coat. How could Harper have done anything but fall in love with him? "Come to me," she says. "Not tonight. I..." His voice breaks off, and Harper imagines Sadie snatching the phone from his hand. Harper has harbored a sense of foreboding since she woke up that morning. She feels like her Siberian husky, Fish, when his ears prick. That dog can hear a mouse fart 3 miles away. "I have to stay here with my family." "It isn't your family," Harper wants to point out. "It's Sadie's family." "My family just died," Harper says. Reed is quiet, whether out of guilt or because he's distracted, Harper isn't sure. "Have you called your sister?" he asks. "Or your mother?" "My mother," Harper thinks. "Ha." If Harper calls Eleanor to say that Billy has died, her mother will sniff or cough in response. Maybe. There was a time, during the heavy shelling of the divorce, when all Eleanor had wanted was for Billy to drop dead. At her most gracious, she might say, "I'm sorry for your loss, darling, but with all that smoking, Billy really had it coming." Eleanor hadn't always felt that way, of course. Once upon a time, Eleanor Roxy Frost and Billy Frost were a dynamic, magnetic couple. Eleanor, a prominent fashion designer, Billy, the owner of Frost Electrical Contractors, Inc. They lived on Beacon Hill in a house they inherited from Eleanor's parents, and there they raised identical twin girls. They did things properly. They attended Church of the Advent one Sunday a month, as well as on Christmas and Easter, like good Episcopalians. They sent the twins to Windsor, the private all-girls school where both Eleanor and Eleanor's mother had gone. Billy and Eleanor attended parties at the Park Plaza, the Museum of Fine Arts, and the Harvard Club. At social events, they were photographed so often that they developed a trademark stance. Eleanor would beam at the camera, while Billy snaked an arm around her waist and kissed her cheek. They were Boston sweethearts. The city adored them. Ultimately, Harper supposes, it was success that ruined them. Eleanor's dresses became so popular that she was able to open a 3-story eponymous boutique on Newbury Street. For nearly 2 years, Eleanor was at the building night and day, overseeing renovations and designs. A photograph of Eleanor wearing a pencil skirt, stiletto heels, and a hard hat, giving the camera a working girl's come-hither look, appeared in Women's Wear Daily. That had been the first thing to set Billy off. "Your mother," Billy said, holding the photograph up for display over the breakfast table, "is only happy when she's 100% in control." The real issue, the twins soon learned, was that Eleanor hadn't hired Billy's company to do the electrical work on her boutique. She refused to do so on principle. She said she felt that working together would ruin their marriage. "That's a bunch of baloney," Billy said. "Your mother is a secret snob. She doesn't want the fancy photographers capturing a picture of her working-class husband. She has always thought she married beneath her." There were loud fights that year, Harper remembers. Billy accused Eleanor of abandoning her family for the store. Eleanor resented what she called Billy's foot on her throat. Why didn't he want her to succeed? He'd known from the first night he met her that she'd wanted a career. Billy decided that the only way to get Eleanor to stay home was for him to go out more. He started spending 3 and 4 nights a week at the Era Pub in Dorchester with a group of men Eleanor characterized as thugs. Billy's friends were no better than Whitey Bulger and the Winter Hill Gang, she said. "Au contraire," Billy said, his French accent impeccable even after he'd had 6 or 7 whiskeys, thanks to the many years he'd spent living with Eleanor. These friends of his from Southie were above board. They were encouraging Billy to run for city council. "Over my dead body," Eleanor said. "I should be so lucky," Billy said. Billy and Eleanor divorced the summer before the twins left for their respective colleges. The twins were 17, still minors, and with Tabitha heading to Bennington and Harper to Tulane, it would be 4 years at least until the girls were financially independent. It had been Eleanor's idea to split the girls. One would be Eleanor's financial responsibility and live with her during summer vacation, and the other twin would go with Billy. Then, on holidays, the girls would switch parents. What Eleanor could not abide was the thought of split time. Both girls with one parent or the other, their possessions traveling between the households in a suitcase. It was unseemly, Eleanor said. What Harper realizes now is that her mother was terrified of being alone. Eleanor's parents had died. Her sister Flossie had moved to Florida. Eleanor had no friends, only business associates. What Eleanor did not bank on, however, was that both girls wanted to go with Billy. When they finally summoned the courage to announce this, Eleanor laughed dismissively and said, "All girls prefer their fathers. That's a known fact. I certainly preferred mine. But Billy can't afford both of you, so I'm afraid one of you is coming with me. I don't care which one of you it is, because unlike the two of you, I don't play favorites. I love you both the same. The two of you work it out between yourselves, please, by morning." There followed one of the most agonizing nights of Harper's life, an hours-long session of whispered pleading, debating, and bargaining, then finally an out-and-out fight with her sister. Harper argued that she had always been a smidge closer to Billy. She was the athletic one, and she was the one who liked the Red Sox. Tabitha argued that she had been named for Billy's mother, whereas Harper had inherited the maiden name of Eleanor's mother, Vivian Harper Roxy, who was formidable indeed. Therefore, Tabitha said, Harper should go with Eleanor and Tabitha should go with Billy. It had unspooled like that until finally the girls, just short of coming to actual blows, decided to settle the dispute the way they had been settling disputes for 17 and a half years, by shooting rock, paper, scissors. It was a solution Billy had taught them. He claimed that any argument in the world could be solved by rock, paper, scissors. No need for fistfights, lawyers, or war, in Billy's opinion. All you needed was a hand and an understanding of the basic rules. Scissors cut paper, rock smashes scissors, paper covers rock. And then, if you don't like the outcome, Billy would say, you simply ask for the best of three. In determining who would go with Billy, Tabitha shot rock and Harper shot paper. Harper won. Tabitha accused her of cheating. Cheating how? Harper had said. By reading your mind? But she let Tabitha simply ask for the best of three. Again, Tabitha shot rock and Harper shot paper. Harper won. She was going with Billy. It was fair to say that Harper's relationship with Tabitha had never been the same after that. For a handful of years, they remained civil, but they were no longer friends. Billy left Boston altogether. He bought a house on Daggett Avenue in Vineyard Haven, while Eleanor stayed in the gracious four-story townhouse on Pinckney Street. Then, when Eleanor sold her shoe line to Steve Madden, a deal her attorney had advised her to delay until after the divorce, she bought a second home on Nantucket. The girls stayed with their parent every summer, and, as per Eleanor's mandate, each traveled to visit the other parent during the holidays. Harper used to imagine their ferries bouncing over each other's wakes and the contrails of their planes crisscrossing in the sky. There had been one chance for the twins to reunite, and that was after Tabitha gave birth to her second child, a son, Julian, 3 months prematurely. Tabitha needed help, and Harper swooped in to save the day, but things had gone catastrophically wrong. Julian died, and Tabitha had seen fit to blame Harper, not only for Julian's death, but also for winning at rock, paper, scissors, and for causing every single other misery of her adult years. You ruin everything, Tabitha had said. Everything is your fault. That was 14 years ago, and the twins have barely spoken since. Harper realizes that Reed is waiting for her to respond. She doesn't like thinking about her sister or her mother, because this is what happens. It feels like someone has blindfolded and gagged her. I texted Tabitha, Harper says. She'll tell my mother, I suppose. Good, Reed says. Listen, I'm sorry, but I have to go. So you won't meet me? Harper asks. You're going to make me call Drew? This is a desperate, dirty thing to say. Harper told Reed that she has started dating Sergeant Drew Truman of the Edgartown Police Department, and it bothers Reed. Drew has the advantages of youth and a policeman's physique and bachelorhood and his large extended family, and he's a nice guy besides. Sergeant Truman and Dr. Zimmer know each other because of heroin overdoses. Drew has administered Narcan 3 times in the past year, after which he has taken the addicts directly to the hospital, where they were placed in Dr. Zimmer's care. Don't call Drew, please, Reed says. Just go home. Curl up with Fish. Fish is a dog, Reed, not a person, Harper says. Billy just died in the middle of my reading off Pedroia's stats. What you're asking me isn't fair, and you know it. I'll come in the morning, Reed says. Tonight, Harper says. Fine, tonight, he says. But late. Midnight. And not to your house. That's too dangerous. I'll meet you in the parking lot at Lucy Vincent Beach. Do you think that's safe? Harper asks. Before Reed was comfortable coming to her duplex, they used to meet in the back parking lot of the ice rink after hours. It would be deserted this time of year for certain, whereas the beach... It's nearly summer, Reed. There are people everywhere. I realize this, he says, but I'm not driving down island. He must realize how unkind that sounds, because he adds, that's the best I can do if it has to be tonight. It has to be tonight, Harper says. Lucy Vincent at midnight. For 5 minutes, so I can give you a kiss and tell you everything is going to be fine, he says.
Is it?
She says. Yes, he says. Harper goes home briefly to let Fish out. He is a dog, not a person, yet he's standing by the front door waiting for her even though, more often than not these days, he sleeps on his Orvis bed and barely turns his head when Harper comes in. But today he's right there, paws on her thighs, licking her face, giving her all the love he can. He knows. This brings Harper to tears. Her dog knows Billy died, but she feels the need to deliver the news herself. She grabs Fish by the muzzle and looks into his glacier blue eyes and says, Pops is gone, Bob. He keens and rubs his flank against Harper's leg, and she has to practically push him out the door to her front yard, where he pees on the biggest hydrangea bush on the property. Then he comes trotting back into the kitchen, where Harper says, Lamb tonight, in honor of Pops. But Fish doesn't snarf down his food, as he normally does. Instead, he looks up at Harper, as if for permission. Go ahead, she says. And with something like mournful dignity, Fish lowers his head to the bowl. When Harper leaves the house, she drives to our market to grab a six-pack of Amity Island Ale and 3 nips of Jägermeister. The cashier, Robin, has known Harper for 20 years. But Robin is a close friend of Jude's, so Harper is always wary and reserved. You want a bag? Robin asks. Please, Harper says. Maybe Robin has heard the news about Billy already, because she throws a milk bone for Fish into the bag for free. It's 8:30, and the sun has just set. Harper prefers winter, when it gets dark at 3:30 and is pitch black by the time she finishes her shift. The summer sun reveals too much. Harper opens one of the beers using the metal end of her seatbelt and chugs half of it. Then she upends one of the nips of Jaeger into her mouth. Her mother would be appalled. Harper should have taken Middle Road, because State Road brings her right by Jude's house, where Harper sees cars and trucks lining the street on either side of the Garden Goddesses sign. It's Jude's annual start of summer party for her staff. She has a pig roast and makes cornbread and green apple slaw from scratch, and there's a big galvanized tub filled with beer. Jude's partner, Stella, makes mudslides in the blender, and everyone listens to Jack Johnson, and the newbies think, wow, what a great place to work. Only the returning employees know that this is the last day they'll have off until Labor Day, when Jude throws a second party with lobsters. Harper hits the gas. She can't get past Jude's property fast enough. Siren. Lights. Harper checks her rearview. Police. She hisses and looks at the open container next to her, but there's no time to dispose of it and no place to hide it. She puts her blinker on and pulls over. This is the last thing she needs. Her reputation has already been shredded, sullied, and stomped upon with steel-toed boots. 3 years earlier, Harper was arrested for doing a favor for a man named Joey Bowen, whom she knew only casually. He was a frequent patron at Dahlia's, where Harper waitressed one night a week. The favor was to deliver a package to the son of one of Jude's landscaping clients, the Monacos. Harper was scheduled to mow the lawn and weed the beds at the Monaco house the following day. All she had to do was hide the package in her wheelbarrow beneath the mulch and fertilizer and bring it to the house. The Monaco's son would come outside to collect it. Harper was supposed to park the wheelbarrow outside the side door and turn her back, and for this, Joey Bowen would pay her $3,000. Harper realized she was probably delivering drugs, but the offer was too tempting to turn down. She needed the money. At that point, she was still living in Billy's house. She wanted a place of her own, but the vineyard was expensive, and it was hard to get ahead. Little did Harper know that the state police and FBI had been watching the Monaco house for weeks, waiting for this particular delivery. When the son grabbed the package, agents hopped over the fence, dropped out of trees, and came charging across the lawn. The kid got cuffed, and so did Harper. During the interrogation, Harper explained to the police that this was the one and only time she had ever delivered anything for anybody. Joey Bowen was a customer at the restaurant where she worked, she said. They informed her that Joey Bowen was wanted for drug trafficking from the Upper Cape all the way down to New Bedford. Harper spent 18 hours in lockup until Billy found her an attorney. She was released, receiving only 6 months probation, but she lost her job, both at Garden Goddesses and at Dahlia's. Jude Hogan openly despises Harper for tainting her landscaping business. The other people who hate Harper are a scarier but far less visible lot, the people who used to buy their drugs from Joey. But the worst thing, perhaps, was that the Monaco's next-door neighbor was a woman named Anne Lane Crenshaw, who also happened to be Eleanor Roxy Frost's college roommate. Eleanor heard about Harper's arrest immediately, and she no doubt shared the appalling news with Tabitha. How could Harper not suddenly feel like the blackest of sheep? Anyone else would have left the vineyard. It's a testimony to how pathetic Harper is that she has stayed. She has nowhere else to go. And her father is here. Was here. Tears arrive unbidden. Her father has just died. She'll just tell the officer that. Play the sympathy card. She puts down her window. She has pulled over about 100 yards beyond Jude's property line. She dreads anyone from that party seeing her. Hey, baby. She looks up. It's Drew. What? She says. She checks her rear view. It's an Edgartown police car, not a car from West Tisbury. She sinks back in her seat while relief drains through to her feet. Did you really have to pull me over? You're so beautiful, you're breaking the law, he says. He leans in her window to kiss her. Plus, you were speeding.
I was, she says.
Why are you all the way out here? He asks. I've been trailing you since I saw you leaving our market.
You have? She says.
Drew is a little stalkerish by nature. Possibly he suspects she's keeping a secret.
Don't you have work?
I'm on break until 9, Drew says. I was driving out to meet you at the hospital, actually, when I saw your car.
He eyes the beer.
You'll want to be careful with that.
I'm going to drive to Aquinnah. Clear my head, she says. It's sweet that you're worried about me, but like I said on the phone, I think I just need to be alone.
Drew nods.
She's a sucker for him in his uniform. He's so handsome, so upright, such a relentless do-gooder. Why can't she be in love with Drew?
The aunties are making you a pot of lobster stew, he says. I'll bring it by tomorrow.
You told them about Billy already? Harper asks.
I called my mother to let her know, Drew says. Wanda and Mavis were over, helping her end beans, so they overheard. Wanda left right away to start the stew. It's their automatic response to death. A pot of something warm and comforting so you don't forget to eat and waste away to skin and bones.
They don't have to go to the trouble, Harper says. They don't even know me.
They know I like you, Drew says. He bends in for another kiss. That's all that matters.
Harper smiles and puts up her window.
At midnight, Harper is mostly asleep in the front seat of her Bronco, 5 of the beers and 2 of the nips consumed. Plus, she stopped at Allie's general store for a jar of their bread and butter pickles,
her dinner. The aunties are right to be concerned. There has been no one in the parking lot since 9:45 when a bunch of high school kids came off the beach. Harper is relieved. Lucy Vincent is still perfectly safe. Reed pulls in at 12 o'clock on the dot. He's nothing if not prompt. Harper brings her seat back up and gets out. He said 5 minutes, and Harper knows that's what she'll get. No more, no less. He shuts off the engine of his Lexus, climbs out, and jogs over to her. He holds out his arms, and she collapses against him. "He's gone," she says. "I'm never going to see him again." That's the thing, I guess. The inconceivable thing. Reed squeezes her tighter. He's a doctor. Dealing with death is part of his job. Not every day, but often enough. He says, "We're all going to die, Harper. Billy's end was peaceful. He had the person he loved most in the world right there with him, reading off Bedroya's stats. What a way to go." Harper raises her face, and their lips meet. Reed's lips are warm. Kissing him lights her on fire all the time. But tonight, because she is ragged from crying, the desire she feels is raw and overpowering. He responds to her, opening his mouth and searching out her tongue, pressing his lower body against hers. He moves his mouth to just under Harper's ear. His hands are all over her. They're going to have sex. Harper can't believe it. He must have had a couple of beers at the family picnic and maybe a scotch once he got home, since he's not on call this weekend. He's looser than normal, nearly reckless. His hands travel inside her blouse. He unhooks the front clasp of her bra. He plays with her nipples, then bends his head down and sucks her left nipple until she groans. She can't stand it. She strokes the front of his jeans. He frees a hand to unzip himself, and Harper reaches for the car door. "No," he says, "outside." "Outside?" she says. "Is this Reed? Reed Zimmer?" He doesn't even bother with protection, something he is fanatical about. He simply thrusts inside her. Harper's back is pressed up against the door of the Bronco, and it's at that second that Harper sees headlights. Passing, she thinks. But no, a car is turning into the parking lot. It's approaching. Harper struggles to disengage, but Reed doesn't notice the lights or the sound of the engine. He's too intent on his rhythm, and his eyes are closed. He finishes with a grunt and a shudder, a soft cry uttered against Harper's neck. Harper pushes him away, but it's too late. A car door slams, and a woman is shouting, screaming, shrieking, "Reed! Reed! Reed!" It's Sadie.